The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. And another interesting and, I promise you, very informative program today. I've already been learning quite a bit about spaceflight history, but more about that in just a minute as I introduced our guests. First, a couple of usual announcements. For those of you who would like to call and talk with us today on the program, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners, so let the phone ring, be patient, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you outside the United States that would like to call us, a couple of things. Number one, make sure that your country allows toll-free calling back to the United States. And if that hurdle is cleared, our toll-free number is with MCI, so you want to ask for your MCI in-country operator. And then you want to give them that toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, and tell them it goes to a toll-free number in the San Francisco Bay Area. And hopefully you can connect. Now, if that doesn't work and you're still dedicated and want to give us a call, if you email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, I will give you the actual telephone number that the toll-free number is connected to. And you can direct dial that number from wherever you are based upon whatever your in-country calling plan is for direct dialing to the United States. Otherwise, you can use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can use our blog, which is at our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to the upcoming show menu bar, and we're the first program listed on that. And then you click on that, and it opens up the blog page and archive page for this particular program. And then down at the bottom is where you can offer comments and questions. And just do that, and as soon as I get your transmission, I will be able to integrate your program, your question and comment on air. But the preferred way is the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And backup is email drspace@thespaceshow.com. While you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, we do have a comprehensive website newsletter, and it's going to be uploaded after today's program ends. So it will have all the programs for this week detailed. And if you scroll down on the website newsletter, you will also see the programs we have planned, and we're now booking into fourth quarter 2018. Again, if you have any questions, do let me hear from you. If you'd like to subscribe to our email newsletter, which is very short, please send me your email address. It goes out at 6 a.m. California time Monday morning. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or quickly download a show. In the upper left menu on our homepage, there is something called support, and under that you'll see a store with Cafe Press. So this is if you want to get hats or t-shirts or dog clothes or something with the Space Show on it, this is where you would go to do that. Also in the upper left menu is the very important Listen Live button. So please share this information if you would like, but it tells you how to listen to live programs, archived MP3s on our website, podcasts, and those of you using Alexa through Amazon and TuneIn, the TuneIn player is embedded, and you can use that. I know people also use TuneIn for their podcasting, but again, the player is specifically for Alexa, if that is a service that you are using. Do remember that we are trademarked and copyrighted. You are absolutely free to download our programs and share and distribute them, although it is much easier to just send somebody the URL where the program is archived. There's a couple of rules about that. Don't do anything commercial with our program. Don't edit, clip, or cut our programs. Don't put anything up on YouTube regarding the program, or for that matter, on your own website. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And if you have an exception and feel compelled to do something with one of our shows, please simply email me in advance, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we can probably work something out. And I'm happy to get those emails from you. Also, our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com website pages, as well as nonprofit pages, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are listener-supported, which means that your financial support keeps the Space Show on the air. And we thank you very much for that support. If you like our programming, our guests, the interaction you can have with our guests, the blog, well, please step forward and help support us, because it doesn't come for free. And we certainly thank those of you who have and are continuing to make contributions to the Space Show, and those of you who will be making contributions. Remember, as a 501c3, we are a nonprofit, which means if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you are paying California taxes. We're known as a public benefit corporation in California. One more quick point before turning over to our guest today. We do have sponsors, and those sponsors get banner ads running across our homepage, and they can change those banner ads as often as they would like. Plus, on full-length programs, of which today is one, I read a short message from each sponsor as we lead off with the first segment, and then also later as we lead off with the second segment. So sponsors for the first segment today include Northrop Grumman, a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers on a global basis. They have capabilities and technologies for applications ranging from undersea to outer space and even into cyberspace. The Space Foundation is also a sponsor, spacefoundation.org. They have their annual space report available now, and this documents the economic value and commerce and what's happening both with the public sector and the private sector. And it does also include the entrepreneurial startups and the new space community to the degree that they are now able to be tracked. So again, all of this is at spacefoundation.org. Also sponsored by the Space Development Network, which is an online organization that allows you to join together with other to advance the plan for space development, i.e. settlement. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. The network is free to join, and their website for more information is spacedevelopment.org. Finally, but not really last for the first segment, is the National Space Society. So in addition to their ISDC, very famous conference that they have around Memorial Day every year, they're also engaged in quite a few other projects, many of which are supported by Space Show listeners, like Space Settlement Work. They publish a great magazine called Ad Astra. We're, in fact, doing a special space show about Ad Astra Tuesday night. So check them out. They are also a nonprofit, and it is nss.org. And we thank those sponsors, and we'll tell you about our other sponsors when we lead off the second segment. Our guest today is Michael Cianconi, and he is an engineer with NASA at JSC in Houston. He currently serves as a NASA lead for safety and mission assurance on the European service module of the Orion program. He has his BS in engineering with an interest in fluid and thermal services and a Bachelor of Arts in psychology from Case Western Reserve. In addition to other information which you can read on his bio, which is on our website, he has prepared his new book, which we're talking about today, Forward to Spaceflight, an illustrated bibliography of pre-1958 publications on rocketry and space travel. It's published this year by Apogee, and it's an update to his previous very well-known, highly regarded publication, The Literary Legacy of the Space Age, by Amor Press from 1998. And in his spare time, he chairs the History Committee of the American Astronautical Society, and is a member of the History Committee of the IAA. Among his AAS activities, he manages the Ordway Award for Sustained Excellence in Spaceflight History and the Emmy Award for Astronautical Literature. Again, his full bio is on our website. I urge you to read it. We would like to talk with Mr. Ciancone and learn about this book. I was surprised to know that there was that much in the literature field on spaceflight pre-1958. Michael, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Doing fine, David. Thanks.
Pleasure to have you on board. Introduce us to your book, which may take us a little bit into your previous book, since this is a type of sequel. And as I asked you a few minutes ago, I really was surprised to learn that there was that much literature about spaceflight, not just in English, but around the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks would assume that the amount of literature published before Sputnik on rocketry and spaceflight would fill maybe a pamphlet. But so far, I've been able to account for upwards of 240 unique titles, not counting editions and such, in all languages, English, French, Spanish, Italian, German. And then in this recent edition of my bibliography, I've included an addendum that I developed with a lot of support from Professor Asif Siddiqui at Fordham. Asif is, as you probably know, one of the foremost authorities on Soviet spaceflight and author of Challenge to Apollo. So between the two of us, we put together our various lists and began filling in blanks and identifying a lot of the Russian titles that were published before Sputnik as well, and came up with something like 150 titles. So that catches a lot of people by surprise to discover that there were so many books. When I say publications, I mean books, not magazine articles, that were published before before Sputnik. The Sputnik date is just an arbitrary cutoff. I wanted to bookend what essentially is my collecting interest and my research interest. And so that was as convenient as anything, because after Sputnik, there was quite a proliferation of publications. And then when we entered the manned spaceflight era, everybody was jumping on board, and you couldn't turn around without finding a book or a magazine on the topic. So my focus has been more on the era when individuals and amateur societies were really developing and nurturing the dreams of spaceflight, the excitement. And this was before it was cool to be into spaceflight. So for many of them, it was an uphill struggle. One of the aspects of the bibliography, this new edition, is through the advent of improvements in publishing technology, which helps to drive down the cost, we were able to include images of many of the publications that we're talking about. And as one person I've known referred to it as a visual feast, it evokes quite an era when you look across the board of the images displayed on the covers, particularly of the 1920s and 30s, of what they envisioned space vehicles to look like. They're never boring. They're often very colorful. And I think that that's an area of study that the space artists in particular tap into.
Does science fiction count in this area, like the early Rocky Jones rocket ships and Tom Corbin and things like that?
Well, the images might lead you to believe as such, and maybe one influenced the other, but what I cover is what I call speculative nonfiction. So I'm interested in real plans and actual research into what it would take to to put a human in space or to launch a rocket into space and go to other planets. Of course, there's a touch of science fiction in that, depending on the level of technology at the time, but I wasn't looking for the novels about space pirates and such, so no, those are not included in here. This is all speculative nonfiction by the likes of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in the Soviet Union. Robert Goddard is the name we know best here in the United States. Roman Obert was one of the early he was one of the early influences in Germany and throughout many other areas of the world. And these were people that were developing the scientific theory. Other folks were doing tests with rockets, and still others were talking about what this all means. What are the prospects? What is this, just a plaything, or what are we going to do with this, from meteorological applications to interplanetary voyages? Some were dreaming much further afield than others.
I mentioned when I was introducing you that I was surprised to find that this was all not just done in English-speaking countries, because I know England had a big interest with the interplanetary, their interplanetary space activities early on in the United States. But is English the most prevalent language, or did you find sufficient information in other languages?
I don't actually have a count of how many within each language, but I would say that there were a lot, particularly in the early years, in German. So in the 1920s and 30s, you'll see a lot of German language material. That's where the VFR, German Society for Spaceship Travel, was operating out of, and they were doing research just outside of Berlin. This was an amateur society that had some hits and misses. Werner von Braun was an early member of that organization. In the United States, we were a little later getting started, as were the British, not until the 1930s. And even then, it was strictly limited to a few amateur societies, the American Interplanetary Society. You had a Cleveland Rocket Society. You had other organizations throughout the country, but these were small amateur groups. So the bulk of the English language material really occurs in the 40s and 50s, but if you're talking 20s and 30s, it's probably German. There was also a lot of Russian material published in the teens, 20s and 30s as well, by Tsiolkovsky, Nikolai Uranin, and a few of their colleagues. They were actively investigating the exploration of the cosmos.
You already have an email coming in. Josh is in Tucson, and he said, I'm wondering how scientifically accurate some of these very early writings were about spaceflight, in particular possibly human spaceflight. Did they have a good understanding of it? Were they close on to being correct, or did they miss the mark?
Well, the rocket equation was developed by Tsiolkovsky in Russia, and then others developed that further. As far as the application of the technology and what could be done, you'll see discussions in the 20s even of what it would be like for a human to operate and live in weightlessness. Some of them got it right, some of them got it wrong, but they were laying the groundwork and building upon the work of each other to evolve it. But people like Goddard, who was a physicist, was well-grounded in the technical aspects of this. Tsiolkovsky was a self-taught person, but obviously he was, since he developed the rocket equation, it's clear that he had a good grasp of what was going on. And Obert in Germany was also a theoretician, so the technical basis of some of these things was pretty solid. The applications were speculative until we actually went into space, just as when we speculated on what we would encounter when we first landed on the moon. So, or how a human would survive or not in microgravity and in space. Until we launched the first human, there were still debate on those topics. And so you'll see a wide range of theories, speculations in the early writings. But that's what makes it so colorful and so interesting, because these were the dreamers and the early doers, the amateurs, before space became a big money industry. And so you had people for whom this was a passion that they dove into every day. So what I'm doing here is collecting, compiling, accumulating examples of those early dreams, and to affirm that excitement. Sometimes we get a little bland and blasé about space activities, with space station going overhead every 90 minutes and the current plans to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and maybe we lose sight of the excitement, why we were going there, what the curiosity was that drove us, the excitement that was behind all that.
You have another email from Sheila, who says she's in St. Louis, and she says, I'm curious if any of these early writers talked about actual space businesses in space making money, or did they talk about space as government doing this and that? Did they see private actors, or how was it divided up back then, if at all?
Well, to the large degree, I would say most of them were technical people who were dreamers and who were speculating on going into space. I don't think they paid quite as much regard to the financial basis for what it would take to do their dreams. Some of them did talk about it. I don't recall seeing too much in the way of early projections of turning this into space businesses. You see a lot of that in science fiction where, you know, young stowaway goes onto a rocket by some big corporation and goes off into space. But these early speculators, when they talk about going into space, they don't address it as a business venture. They talk about it more in terms of exploration, to go because that's where it is, and go to Mars and go to the moon. Not as a business venture, but as a part of the continuing tradition of exploration.
Are most of these books still available in print, or are they only at a handful of libraries? If people are actually interested in finding some of them and reading them, how do they do that? Are they on Amazon's use list? How do you access them?
Most of them are long out of print, and some of the early ones, especially pre-World War II, are in high demand by collectors of this field. It's a rather niche field of book collecting, but you could probably say that about many areas of book collecting. They're niche field. But it's a rather passionate group. You'll see some of the key titles have been republished. In fact, through the American Astronautical Society, for which I serve as the chair, we worked with Oldenburg in Germany to publish an English language translation of Hermann Oberth's 1923 book, which is considered a seminal publication in rocketry. So it came out in German, and I was surprised to discover a few years ago it had never been translated into English, so, or at least not in a form that was commercially available. There were some internal translations done for NASA that were never commercially published. So we took it upon ourselves to get together folks both on the technical side and on the history side to go through the book and translate it and put it into a good context so we can provide some understanding of what he was saying. Some of the phrasing that Oberth used in the 20s sounds a little odd to us, so we were trying to help translate that as well. And then Oldenburg put that out as well as a republication of the original. So by that means, we were trying to make those early important documents available. We've seen other republications. For example, Apogee Press out of Canada, back in the early 2000s, republished The Conquest of Space by David Lasser. That was the first book in English on it was a technically serious treatment of the use of rockets for sending humans into space. So that one's currently available. But by and large, you'd have to go to libraries to consult. Some of them might be available online. Otherwise, it's a secondary book market through, I don't know, Advanced Book Exchange or eBay, that sort of thing, where you'll find some of these outside of the secondhand book dealer market.
Do you give the likely location for some of these books in your bibliography and your references?
Likely location to finding copies?
Yeah, to finding copies or what library has it or something like that.
No, I don't delve into that. The bulk of my bibliography is just that. It's a bibliographical description. It's of value particularly to researchers, to book collectors, dealers, historians who are wanting to know what was published on a particular topic or idea and how far back. So it gives you a view of the scope of the publication. As I said, there are upwards of 240 unique titles, not counting the Russian language titles before Sputnik. So you're going to have a lot of these that are out there, and the bibliography will serve that. But in addition, I try to put that into perspective in the upfront material to give a short history of spaceflight. And anybody who's read any of the classic spaceflight histories, this is only a synopsis of that. My intent there was to incorporate the books, the key books, the seminal publications, into that context so that you could see where things are popping up along the way. And then, of course, as I said, the Russian language addendum is the brand new part of this, because what Asif and I put together, I don't think has ever been done before. So this is the first time we've ever had a view at the sheer scope of the writings in Russian prior to Sputnik. So that's a long answer to your short question about do I identify in here anything, location of the books? Short answer to that is no. I already gave you the longer answer.
Another email from you. Paul is in New York, and he says, I'm not purposely trying to introduce politically correct information into the discussion because I don't believe in that. But I am curious if any of the early authors or people engaged in space or thinking about it or rocketry were women. Are any of the authors of some of the early books women?
Good question. One of the founding members of the American Interplanetary Society was a woman in the 30s. I'm hard-pressed to think of any of the early members of the German Rocket Society. So that's society activities there. And usually the women who were involved had a relationship of some sort with other members of the society and participated via that relationship. In terms of publications, you know, I'd have to go back and look. That's a good question. When would be the first publication by a woman that appears in my bibliography? And I can't point to anything specifically right offhand prior to the late 40s. I'd have to go back and look, though, but that's a good question.
Growing up, so I'm in my early 70s, so I guess I'd be talking about the early 50s. We won't count the late 40s. But for people who were interested in space, such as myself, and we knew about Goddard and other people, but in terms of the general public, in terms of growing up in the 50s and the 60s, we never came across these books unless we had a reason or a teacher or somebody to point us in the direction of, say, Robert Goddard or something like that. Or you go to New Mexico and you could see the museum, although I don't know when his museum got founded. When was this always like a special tiny little niche in the book market? Was it ever more mainstream rocketry and spaceflight, and then somehow it became a niche field? I just don't remember any teachers or anyone even talking about this. They did talk about science books and other things like that in school, especially as we got into middle school or junior high school and high school, but nothing in this direction. So I'm wondering how it became such a specialized niche market, or is there any explanation for it?
Are you referring to the evolution of rockets for spaceflight and
I think thinking
about the exploration of space?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe, you know, how did it evolve into sort of a very specialized narrow field rather than, you know, being more widely read or widely accessible or even known about, where school kids might do a report on this or that.
Sure.
I just never saw it. I grew up in Oklahoma. Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know if, say, growing up in Los Angeles was any different. I just never came across it.
Well, a lot of people were perhaps first introduced to this in a large way by the Collier series of articles in 52 to 54, which were soon published in book form, where a lot of the artwork by Chesley Bonestell, Rolf Klepp, and Fred Freeman was pulled together in books like Across the Space Frontier. And that was not niche. That was big time publishing, and the Collier's magazine reached a lot of people. And so what they were doing there with the technical input of folks like Werner von Braun was to build in the reading public a level of excitement and interest in the prospects of space travel. And then you had the collaboration with Walt Disney in the late 50s, so that some would argue, and I know there are books that have been written on this, that talk about the space program being more a fulfillment of public expectation than it is, leading public expectation, telling the people what to expect and what to look forward to. It was merely more of a fulfillment of that. So there was a lot of widespread public writing, magazines, books in the early 50s, in particular in the United States. And I would assume that percolated through to the rest of the world as well.
Interesting. I know Collier's and Walt Disney inspired a lot of people. I also know it led to a lot of science fiction, Tom Corbett rocket ships and things of that nature. But I don't know.
Well, you know, we had some science fiction folks, or some of the authors that I include in my bibliography are well known within the science fiction field. Some of them under their pen names, but Arthur C. Clarke. Not a pen name, but Arthur C. Clarke is well represented in my bibliography. He wrote many scientifically visionary works. I mean, he proposed the geostationary satellite way back in, I don't know, someone will correct me, but I think it was 45. In addition to a lot of the science fiction that he's known for, but as far back as 1950, he wrote a book called Interplanetary Flight, An Introduction to Astronautics, that was intended to serve as a primer for folks interested in that. So, you know, there was crossover with science fiction, even in fact, the early members of the American Interplanetary Society, for the most part, were associated with, I think it was Wonder Stories magazine under Gernsback, and David Lasser was his chief editor at the time, and his intention in writing his book, The Conquest of Space, was the result of his efforts to look into the technical feasibility of a lot of these notions that were coming out about rockets into space. And he said, is this for real? You know, he was reading over a lot of the science fiction articles that were submitted to the magazine, but he was also hearing about a lot of other stuff going on, and he was trying to separate out what was technically viable and what was more a literary gimmick. So there was a lot of there's a good number of science fiction folks represented here.
You have another note from Ben, who is in Tucson, and he says, I'm curious how you were able to access and discover the data. So obviously much of this was done pre-digitized format times. So I'm wondering if, in the meantime, it is still available out there someplace in a print format for you to have found, or was it digitized in archives someplace, and it exists only because somebody saved it in a digitized format, or was it hard to find given we're going to digitize formats and doing away with paper and so many different things?
Okay. No, it was not. I did not get most of this from digital format. The basis for the bibliography goes back to probably the early 90s. As a collector, someone who collects books, I enjoy the printed material, and I came across a few early titles. And so I was curious to read more of the very early material that was written by the dreamers and the visionaries in their own words. And I thought that tied into my career working for NASA, because it really put into context why we're doing what we're doing today. And as I had said previously, it serves also to remind one of the excitement and the passion that really characterized those early efforts. So I started pulling together a small collection, you know, a half shelf of books, and I would go to used booksellers back in the day when brick and mortar stores still existed besides Barnes and Noble. And I would browse the shelves, and I would ask them if they had any early books on rocketry and spaceflight. Their response was typically, well, if you tell me what you're looking for, I can tell you if I have it. So it was sort of a catch-22 at that point. So what I did was I began to assemble a list of the books that I knew that existed, because they were listed in the bibliographies of the books that I had. And typically if I found one on the shelf at a book dealer's store, I would find several more. So my collection began to grow in that fashion. And when I really got wind of the notion that there were not just a few dozen books from the early years, but hundreds, you know, I said, I'd really like to get my arms around what exactly, how large, what the scope is of books from that era. So I would carry around my list with me, and then book dealers kept asking me for my list so that they could use it as a reference guide. So in response to the question, I'm a book collector, amongst other things, and I have many of these titles, which gives me good opportunity to scan those covers and include images. I've also had a number of contacts from around the world who very graciously provided me with scanned images of titles that are in my bibliography but that I don't have or had not seen. So they would scan the cover, send it to me, we put it into the bibliography, and properly credit it. So that's where a lot of these come from. Now, in terms of the digital versus published, I hate to think that the digital era is going to be the demise of the hardcover publication. And in fact, the preface to the bibliography, which I adapted from as an intro to a catalog for an exhibit in Italy a few years ago, talks about the relevance of the printed book in the digital era. And specifically, you know, the example that I often give to people is that early in my career when I was doing research engineering, we were taking data and storing it on these floppy disks. Not the little ones. These were the larger ones that, you know, what are they, 8-inch?
Or 6-inch or whatever they were, yeah.
Yeah, they were just, I mean, they were literally big floppy. And you had applications that you used to store those, store that data. I have those disks, but I can't access that data anymore because those applications are long gone. But I'll tell you what, I still have the reams of printout of that data. It's in the bottom file drawer in my office, and I lug it around with me from location to location. Now, that data is not going to be of particular value to anyone, I don't think. Anything of relevance would have been published. But, you know, the electronic media, I think we're going places when we can find a way of digitizing and putting it in a form that it will be accessible to future generations who are using whatever the next iteration of iPhones and iPads and computers are, so that it isn't lost for lack of an application program. I also point out that my books will survive a low EMI burst, so low-level EMI burst. And, you know, the biggest threats to the printed material are smoke, water, and fire.
You've got a caller on hold, but Jake is in Denver, Colorado, with a question for you. And he said that when David was introducing you, he talked about your work focusing on safety and mission assurance. I'm wondering if in the early writers talking about space flight and people going to space, safety was ever mentioned or even a consideration.
Well, I think it's safe to say it wasn't quite the consideration that it is today. You know, there are folks who suggest that as we grow more complex, that we become overly cautious and try to minimize or eliminate every possible threat and risk presented to us. I worked with a summer intern a number of years ago, about 20 years ago, to actually do a safety assessment of the early testing done by the American Rocket Society. We had some film clips and the post-test write-ups that were in the bulletins or the journal at the time. And I asked her to do a safety assessment as if this were, you know, regular launch. So there were a lot of things that the Amateur Rocket Society folks were doing that we would probably frown upon these days in terms of pouring liquid oxygen out of large jerry cans into I don't know, they were transferring it from one point to another. Ignition could be by someone running out lighting the fuse underneath until they really get the hang of the electrical ignition thing. I mean, you do hear reports of that. So we know they were doing things in a fashion that was much riskier than we would ever accept today. Did they recognize that at the time? Yeah. I mean, you can see they were doing what they thought they could. You will see they were firing off rockets from behind brick walls or mounds of dirt. They were wearing all manner of protective headgear. When they were loading liquid oxygen, they were wearing big padded, I don't know if they were asbestos suits, but they were conscious of what they were dealing with, but I don't think they were particularly high-tech at the time. So I think that they were cautious of that from an operational standpoint when it came to launching the early rocket. Now, when you talk about hazard, I'll try not to veer off too much since that's my what I do for a living, but when I do the safety and mission assurance. But when you look at the hazards associated with humans in space, some of the early writers did address those specific things like micrometeoroids and orbital debris, radiation, how you're going to function in microgravity. So those were some of the key ones. It was primarily focused on the physiological aspects of spaceflight that they were talking about when there was a discussion of humans going into space. But there was also an awareness, I think, of safety related to ground launch operations they learned a bit by trial and error. As I said, electrical ignition was something they quickly adopted as being a wise move. You don't want to have people go running out there to light the rocket and other things as well. So that's a good question. I appreciate that, particularly in light of my 18 mission assurance work.
We may come back to that topic in the second period, but you do have a caller online that we'll take, and then we'll go to our break. Let's see. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please? Thank you for calling.
This is Marshall, and I'm out here in the wheat fields of Oklahoma.
Okay.
And one of the things that both of you kind of touched on was what I refer to as technology lag. Somebody would come up with a new piece of technology or a new concept, and it literally in the 20s and 30s, it took years to disseminate to all the people that were interested. And today, it's kind of like somebody puts out a new theory, it's kind of like pop culture, and, you know, everybody knows about it within 3 months. Did you see that in doing your research, the slow change in how communications and information got disseminated?
Well, no, that's a good question. Appreciate that. Yeah, obviously they didn't have the internet, so there was a limitation in the speed at which information could be disseminated. But certainly in the 20s and through at least the first part of the 30s, there was exchange of information amongst the amateur rocket societies in Germany and in the United States and in Britain through their monthly newsletters, their periodicals, and personal contacts. When G. Edward Pendray would visit the Germans and witness some testing, for example. So that was the primary method of sharing was through their journal publications and then the personal contact, but that was far from efficient.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, you had people like Goddard, who was a bit of a loner. He declined to actively participate or correspond with the amateur rocketeers, and he typically declined to invite them to his testing. So whatever accomplishments he had were limited to what he published and what he patented and released. So that would be years and years in the making and may have unduly diminished his influence on the field of rocketry. Then you take guys like Tsiolkovsky in Russia. You know, his stuff wasn't really getting out much, and how many of the folks receiving it would actually be able to read his material in the original Russian? So the effect and influence was relatively limited for Tsiolkovsky because of the language differences.
You have a very good point there. The language barriers, and me being a software engineer, I know the first thing I do is I go through and define my variables, and my definition of variable names don't necessarily match up with everybody else. So you could write something that was mathematically perfect, and nobody would understand it because of the words you chose to describe each variable.
Yeah, we try to make sure we at least get units of measure like feet and meters right these days. So,
it's.
I mean, something as simple as that, units of measure, doesn't have to be the spoken or written language. Germany was probably in a good position because they were proximate to Russia, and there was some potential for exchange of material. In the United States, being further away, you know, I did see an article fairly recently about someone trying to determine how much Tsiolkovsky's material actually entered into the thinking here, whether it was referenced by anyone or whether copies of his publications were ever received by book dealers, especially in the Russian emigrated areas. So, that exchange didn't occur nearly as fast as it does in the Internet era, but there was some learning that occurred. In the late 30s, the Germans were beginning to pull the veil around the rocket activities and to nationalize that. So exchange of material with the Germans was not all that easy to do, if at all. So it was amongst a lot of the American amateur societies that you would hear a lot about that, as well as the British.
Mm-hmm. I find that whole area very interesting because me being in the computer field, I didn't even know what a computer was until I was a senior in college. And they happened to roll one in, and being in the math department, they said, "Hey, look, computer. Go make it do something interesting." And, you know, there was three of us that were kind of nuts, and we went out and did a couple of algorithms, and, you know, everybody was impressed. And, of course, IBM 1130, by our today's standard, was a joke. But you got to start somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Appreciate your question.
Anyway.
Anything else, Marshall?
No, I was about to cut it off right now. Thank you very much.
Hey, Marshall, I have a question for you, and I'm really serious about this. Okay, and maybe our guest can speak to this, too, although it's not really on the subject. Given where you grew up and the schools you went to, how different would your engineering education have been if you were, say, in Los Angeles or New York or Boston rather than in Oklahoma and northern Texas?
Oh, well, first of all, I grew up in Enid.
Okay, well, that's western Oklahoma. You have a lot of watermelon out there that I like, and rattlesnake.
No, the watermelon's all the way down out at Clio Springs. That's 60 miles away.
But seriously, how different would your educational engineering background and experience have been if you were on either coast, for example?
The key thing is, I would have probably bumped into somebody who was as mathematically oriented as I am. Now, one of my problems is I literally think in binary. And it's a strange talent, but, you know, hey, I think like a computer. If I would have run into somebody that was mathematically oriented, let's say 4 or 5 years earlier in my life, it could have been terribly different. On the other hand, I'm in the top 1% of the mathematical-oriented people, and let's face it, we're all of us in that category are a bit eccentric, and that's, you know, we take off on all sorts of odd things that are just mathematical, because that's our talent. It could have made a big difference. On the other hand, I spent most of my high school years working with my dad building houses, which is, you know, how much difference is it from moving to building houses to building rockets? It's structural engineering. Yeah. It's, you know, it was there. It was just different.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marshall.
Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And listeners, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes, and the toll-free line is available, and we do answer it during the break. It is 1-866-687-7223. So stay where you are. Don't go anyplace, and we will be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Sunday Space Show program. And before we get back to it, let me read our quick second segment sponsor messages for everybody. The Integrated Space Plan is a highly detailed development chart, and it's really a flow chart, and it shows the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. You can explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan, all one word, .com. They have discussions and other activities and regular updates. And the internet version, the website version of the Space Plan is interactive, so you can expand the modules and get lots more information. But you can also buy a full-size copy suitable for framing, hanging on the wall or door. It's very inspiring, especially if you have children that you want to introduce to space. So please do check it out at thespaceplan.com. And the AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Remember, they are the world's largest aerospace pro society, and they have over 30,000 individual members, about 100 countries are involved, and maybe 100 or so corporate members. And they all work in the industry, so they are actually the people shaping the future of the aerospace industry every day. And they advance it with both science, technology, and know-how. And it's a great organization. Their five conferences, they call them forums, are super, unbelievably great networking. Find out more, attend a conference or a forum, and their web address is AIAA.org. And then last but certainly not least is Celestis, and they are still the only provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. They've been doing this since 1994. And you can visit the moon, and you can do advanced preparation either for yourself or for a family member or a loved one or somebody who has recently passed away. If you don't believe in cremation, you can use DNA to send to space on one of their many different missions. They launch from the Cape. They launch from New Zealand coming up. They're going to the moon from New Zealand. And they also do Vandenberg. And they do suborbital flights from Spaceport America in New Mexico. And as I said, you can send your own DNA with the loved one that has passed away or the other person that you're memorializing. Great way to do it, a great way to have closure. And as I said, you can do prepared advanced planning if you're so inclined. You can get all the information about this and more at their website, Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And to be fully disclosed, here I am, their customer, having launched my mom and two dogs into space on three or four of their missions. Let's see, one of them is at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, and I think the others did okay. And one of them, the mom and two dogs, are also scheduled to go to the moon if and when they launch from New Zealand. So it's a great organization. Glad to have them as a sponsor. And, Mike, we got a phone call coming in, so I'll take that before we go to second.
Okay.
Hang on. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the second segment of our Sunday program. Who are you, where are you, and thank you for calling.
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi there, John in Fort Worth. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, I on books that are, okay, pre-58 or that period, the one book I that kind of I ran across when I was very young, grade school, I think it was published in 1952, The Real Book About Space Travel, which was a, there's a whole series of books about real books.
Al Goodwin.
What?
Al Goodwin was the author of that one.
Yes.
Was
I don't know what you're... go ahead with your question. I'm sorry.
Was it any good? Did you think it was a good book, John?
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, at the time, I definitely did. I think it was pretty good for what it was and for the period, yes. I mean, it's not a... You know, it does deal with a lot of the real issues that, as they were known at the time in 1952, I think, some of which haven't really changed that much, you know, about chemical fuels and so forth, you know.
Yeah, that's a good example of a genre of books that I do include in here, and that's books that talk about the work of others. They're targeting young readers like The Real Book About Space Travel. They're targeting the interested public, the non-engineers, the non-scientists. And this was all part of a wider effort to educate and inform the public, to establish a foundation of expectations for what is real, what is the current state of rocketry, and where could this lead us. And that the book you just mentioned, John, is a very good example of that. So those are included in my bibliography because I think that they are important. It's not just books that were written by Goddard, for example, but there are books that others wrote that were attempts to compile the current state, to synopsize the current state of technology and to speculate where it might go. So they weren't actually doing any of the experiments or crafting any of the equations, but they were trying to see where this was going to lead us. That's a good example of it.
Yeah, because it was...
Did you have a follow-on question? Go ahead.
Well, I did run across another book in the library at the time, which... I think it was actually, you said the Oberth, not in English, but this was in English. I think it was by Oberth. It was really, it was far more technical than one I just mentioned. I know that. Because at the time I was probably, I'm not sure where, but I was definitely in my pre-calculus state of math knowledge, so I saw it was a bit, beyond me in places on some of the math that was in it. But it was about space and orbital trajectories, and I think even ion propulsion, I think, was mentioned in it, I think.
Well, if we just focus on the stuff that he published before Sputnik, he did have one English-language book that appeared called Man into Space, New Projects for Rocket and Space Travel, and I'm cheating because I'm looking at my bibliography as we
as we talk. And that was the English language version of a book that first came out in German three years prior. But it does talk about his theory on Earth satellites, space stations, and the sort of equipment that you would expect to be used by space travelers. So it was a bit more technical. It wasn't, you know, but it was, I think he was still directing it more towards popular consumption. I don't think this is the sort of thing that an engineer would pick up and study, but it still served a purpose.
I just remember at the time, of course, I can't remember the exact year this was, and like I said, I definitely hadn't had any college-level math or physics training at the time, so it just seemed a bit more challenging than something like the first one I mentioned. That's what I recall, though.
Yeah, that one came out in 57, and then he had, I think there was one called the Moon Car that came out sometime after Sputnik that was a nice little piece that was very popular. Yeah, Oberth had some stuff published in English. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Okay. Well, I just thought, yeah, those are the two that I could think in that time period. Most, I probably ran across a few others, but certainly something by Clark, I'm sure. And I can't remember the specific title. The one I actually have by him was that Time Life thing, but that was 64, so that's post 58. Yeah. Which is very good. The Man in Space. It was. That was another one I remember in my youth, you know, that I glommed on to. Yeah. All right, well, thanks a lot. I just wanted to bring those two up.
John?
Yes?
Keep in mind that tomorrow, if you are able to listen live to Howard Bloom, he wants to promote his petition that we have mentioned a few times on the show. It'd be great to hear your voice and what you have to say to him.
We'll see. As I will be at work at that time. So
well, it'll be 4 o'clock for you, 4 to 5:30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your call, John.
Okay.
Listeners, the line is available again if you would like to call us, 866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And, Mike, when I was introducing you, I said that you're involved with the European Service Module of the Orion program, and that is one of your current assignments. Can you talk to us about the Orion program, and am I correct in saying that's part of the Orion capsule program, or is this a separate program from the Orion capsule that's being developed?
Well, the part that I'm working on is the European Service Module. So if we think in Apollo terminology, this is the service module, and you also have a capsule, although we call it a crew module, where the crew would inhabit. And I'm working, and the Europeans were, we reached an arrangement with the Europeans to have them do the service module, which will provide in-space propulsion, power, water, oxygen, all of the things you need to keep the crew alive and maneuver the combined spacecraft around. We're expecting to ship the hardware for the first service module from Germany to the Cape at the end of next month. And then the EM-1 launch would be, which is an unmanned launch, would be, I don't know, the dates move around, but I think it's end of next year or early the following year. And then that'll be followed in the early 2020s by the first manned mission or human piloted mission. So, you know, we're taking our little steps and, but the service module part that we have with the Europeans, the significance of that really is this is the Europeans' first opportunity to participate in a human-rated spacecraft from launch through on-orbit operations. They already have a lot of extensive experience with ELVs, expendable launch vehicles, and obviously on space station with some of the modules, and they have crew members. But in terms of something getting up out of the gravity well with people on board, this is a big deal for them. You know, it may be returning U.S. astronauts to space, but for them, it's a really big deal in particular.
So go ahead. No, you go ahead, and then I'll ask you.
Yeah, I was just going to say my role in this is to work as a what I call a cross-cultural international technical coordinator, which means that I may not know much, but I know people who do in the areas of safety and mission assurance, and I coordinate with my counterpart at the European Space Agency and at their prime contractor, Airbus, and as well as with our prime contractor, Lockheed Martin, so that safety issues that arise during assembly, integration, testing of the hardware, and previously during the design phase, so that those issues are addressed.
So do the Europeans design and work the life support issues themselves? Do they follow sort of blueprint instructions given them by NASA? Do they have complete autonomy in the design? Or how is something like this done on an international cooperative effort?
I'm trying to think if the answer is no, yes, no. they do the design. They are not handed, you know, they're not just fabricators. They were given the agreed to, we all had to agree to a set of standards and requirements. Those are negotiated and evolved. And then they go off and do a design. And then the design goes through a preliminary design review, critical design review, in which NASA and Lockheed participate. And then we'll identify issues with the design or anticipated operation or the integration of hardware, because Lockheed will have the responsibilities for integration of the whole spacecraft, the service module with the crew module. So everybody has to play together real nicely on this. And so they will do the design. We're not just handing them a design and saying go fabricate, but we work with them through the design and the issues that they encounter. And so they're going through right now the final testing of the hardware as they prepare to ship it. And we have NASA people over there on site at the Airbus facility to work with them to provide real-time support as issues arise.
And this is primarily done in Germany, or does it also go to France, or is it throughout Europe? How is it spread around?
Well, the way ESA does programs is once they agree that ESA will participate in a program, then each of the participating member states would contribute a certain amount of money towards that project, and that money will come back to industry within those countries in a ratio roughly corresponding to the amount that those nation states put in. So the prime contractor is Airbus, but Airbus also has facilities at Les Mureaux, just outside of Paris. We work with Thales Alenia in Torino, Italy, and Lappolthausen, Germany. So there are facilities scattered throughout, but the central integration and assembly facility, the prime facility, is at Bremen in Northwest Germany.
So they have facilities in the United States now, too. Is that correct?
Airbus?
Yeah, I thought they had something in the United States now. I may be wrong on that.
They may have, but it's not that we're using it for this. So they'll ship the hardware to the Cape, where it'll go into the ONC that Lockheed Martin will be operating as an industrial operating zone. So it'll basically be a NASA facility that Lockheed is operating to integrate the hardware.
Bob is in.
Not exactly space history, but you know, that's part of what I do. It's part of my day job.
Well, it will become space history, right?
Yes, we're looking forward on that, and not so much looking backward.
Bob is in Salt Lake City, and he said, "Is the service module capable of being a lunar lander or modified to be a lunar lander?"
service module?
Yeah, that's what.
No, you've got your consumables on there. You've got pressure vessels that have gases, various fluids. You've got your solar array wings on it. I don't think you would modify the European service module to be a lander. That is not to say we won't plan to land on the moon. I'm just saying that the current design for the European service module does not include modifying it to be a lander.
Yeah, no, Bob, the part of the argument against the LOPG program is people would rather see a lunar lander to go to the surface of the moon rather than to orbit the moon in an orbiting space station. So as far as I understand, there are no plans for a lunar lander until mid-2020s or something along that date.
Our focus right now are on the first two flights. The first one, EM-1, is an unmanned, you could call it a checkout.
Uh-huh.
A test cruise. And then the second one, EM-2, will be the first manned program, if you will. David, if I could.
Sure.
I want to go back on something one of the questions one of your listeners asked about earlier, about whether any of the authors of the books in my bibliography were women.
Okay.
And I did a bit of quick, really, really quick research, as you can imagine, over the break, and I quickly scanned my bibliography, and I only saw the names of four or five women, but they were all typically reporting on either dreams of spaceflight, so they were mentioning some of the work going on, or they were books geared toward the young reader where they were capturing the excitement of spaceflight and what it might mean for the future. I did not note any books in my bibliography written by women that developed the theory or reported on testing of rockets. So it was a good question. Interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. So I'll probably delve into it a bit deeper after we're off the air. But that wasn't the results of my quick results from my research.
Well, if you find something different, you can post it on our blog or send it to me, and I'll post it on your behalf on the blog, and we'll update the listeners with what you found.
Indeed.
Sounds interesting. This is probably an impossible question to answer, but if the Europeans designed their service module, and let's say an American company designed an American version of the service module, do you think their approaches and designs would be radically different, or would they be pretty similar?
But speculative. Certain parts of it, I think, people would do differently, because the European design is based upon, to a large degree, upon their experience with ATV, the automated transfer vehicle to space station. So they are applying their experiences and their technologies and their capabilities to the problem with which they're presented. You know, we say we need a service module that will provide these functions within these constraints. If you ask somebody with a different set of experiences and capabilities, you'll probably get a somewhat different answer. Sure.
So multiple ways to do something, I guess, would be the bottom line. You can design a craft in several different ways to accomplish a similar purpose.
Well, I'd like to believe that there are multiple correct ways of doing it. We just hope they don't pick one of the incorrect ways.
Well, that's what the design and review process is all about, right?
Yeah, we design it, we test it. That's what that's supposed to ferret out. You ended up making a less than ideal selection of materials or a design that has a flaw that you hadn't detected before, then it should be picked up during the testing. We try to ferret out the ones that we can.
Henry is in Atlanta, and he said, if you were writing a more recent bibliography, say from the space shuttle going forward, And again, you're looking for the bibliographical references. Do you think there would be a huge number of entries coming from the new space or the entrepreneurial commercial space sector, or would that not be represented as strongly as many of us who talk about it all the time think it might be?
Good question. I think you'll see probably at least 100 titles a year, and I can say that with confidence because one of the things that I do in my role as the chairman of the History Committee of the American Astronautical Society is to assemble, to compile a list of publications on astronautical publications that come out each year, in at least in English. I haven't yet mastered the ability to do a really comprehensive all languages sort of thing. But if we're just talking English language, we're getting about 100 copies of 100 different titles each year over the past decade, probably. And if you look at only those that touch on the commercial side of the house, I'd say there's a fairly significant chunk of those titles, a fairly significant number that talk about commercialization of space, the XPRIZE. I think one of the recent winners of the Emmy Award for Astronautical Literature was How to Make a Spaceship. I might have gotten the title wrong on that, but that one, that particular book there talks about early entrance into the XPRIZE. And their dreams, their visions, their motivations, their successes, their challenges, and it was quite a compelling read. Other books you'll see coming out talk about commercialized space from a very business-oriented aspect. So there are out there. I wouldn't say they're in the majority, but I wouldn't say it's an insignificant number. You're talking a sizable number of fairly large number of books coming out each year talk about commercialization of space.
I mentioned earlier when I was introducing you your involvement with different organizations, and one of them is the IAC, right, the International Astronautical Congress, and they have a big event coming up in Germany in about 2 months, correct?
That's correct, and coincidentally, perhaps, it's in Bremen, Germany, which is the home location of the prime contractor for ESA. That's where Airbus is located, and they're integrating and testing the spacecraft right now. So that'll be a Congress here 49 years out from the landing on the moon. We're all looking forward to the Congress next year in D.C. on the 50th, as it'll celebrate the 50th anniversary. Within each Congress, the International Academy of Astronautics hosts or organizes a session or sessions on spaceflight history where we will invite papers to be presented on memoirs of actual participants in spaceflight activities or organizational histories or tech hardware histories, that sort of thing. And we then compile these and publish these in the AAS history series that's published by Univeld out of San Diego. So, the spaceflight history folks have an active role in each of these congresses, and we do capture and publish and make available the proceedings of each of those sessions. So this next one will be, I think it's the first week of November?
Yeah, first through 5th in Bremen, yeah.
Right. So I plan to be there for that, whether I'm on business or at conference. I'll either one way or the other.
Are you presenting there, or you're just going to be there?
Yeah, I don't have a paper in the session. I actually had a paper on spaceflight safety in the human spaceflight era, unrelated to history. But we ended up pulling that paper because we're in the midst of the pre-ship review on the hardware, and we didn't really feel that we could devote enough time and attention to to do credit to the paper. So I will be at the history sessions chairing at least one of the panels and participating in the annual history committee meeting of the International Academy of Astronautics.
And then you mentioned next year's is in Washington, D.C., but also later in October. So a little.
I don't know the exact date. You know, it'll be after the actual anniversary. I believe it is in D.C., and it's typically early October. I don't think they're going to move it up to July.
No, I just got their website open. It's October 21st through the 25th.
Right.
They have a very cool website. With the moon behind the Washington Monument, really cool. Whoever did it did a good job.
Yeah, I don't know who did that. I couldn't tell you. Could find out if you really wanted to know, but I don't know offhand.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Mark from Petaluma. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you, Mark?
Good. Your job is. Sounds like a really wonderful job, especially with your hobby, your passion for your hobby, history of spaceflight, seems to dovetail quite nicely into what you do for a living. And I'm curious as to your take on education and how important NASA almost got shut down by Trump about the education, so I'm not sure exactly where that stands, but Has it improved the outlook for education through NASA? Do you consider it important? Where's your stand on that?
Do I consider education to be important?
Yes.
I don't think that was your question, though. Right?
Yeah, to the further endeavors of space travel and the space industry as a whole. How important to you is the NASA education intent? I imagine you're involved in it in some respects because of your interest in history and the various organizations you belong to. But I'm curious about your perspective about the education from a NASA employee's perspective.
Well, I can give you my perspective as Joe Citizen here on the Garden Spot of the Gulf Coast in Houston. Can't speak for NASA, but I can tell you that we regularly host student groups coming through JSC and all sorts of space school activities, high school students, community college students, university students on short-term programs where you're really feeding the interest of a lot of STEM students, science, technology, engineering, and math students, because those are the people that are going to fill your rosters, your payroll in the future. And so just if you think about the sort of, I won't say education, but awareness that the Collier's series served in the 50s and Walt Disney served, that wasn't really education, that was more infotainment, you know, but it excited people. It got them interested. Sputnik led to a surge in focus on education in the STEM fields. I think that's critically important. It's not just scientists and engineers. We require physiologists. We require dietitians. We require technicians. So the space community is more than just science and engineering. What we want to do is to continue to feed the interest and enthusiasm. So, yeah, I think education STEM in the STEM fields in particular is critical, but I have also offered suggestions through the years about using space themes as a study focus for areas unrelated to engineering and science. So you can do it in a health professional course where you say, okay, we have some spaceflight participants and you set up a scenario. So you can use space as an example case and have that as a setting. So I hope that gives you enough enthusiasm and support for your suggestion about education in the field.
Yeah, I just feel like for the next generation, there just seems to be such a lack of appreciation and understanding of in the education system as a whole for this up-and-coming generation. I live right next to a high school, and there's no interest at all. There's no, my kids just finished high school, and they're not interested. My passion is space, and they're not interested.
But Mark, we could talk about whose fault it is as well, but and lament that. I think that a good approach is if you have any solutions locally, because, you know, affecting things nationally might be a bit more limited, but locally, you know, we can each do our own there. I mean, I've got three kids in college right now, and only one of them is in a technology field. So, but I mean, the other two are in good fields and they're pursuing their own interests, and that is fine by me. They need to pursue their own dreams.
Mark,
yes, I agree with that.
Are you suggesting the NASA Office of Education has something to do with the poor science quality in education in public schools?
No, I don't think that. I think for whatever you think about Trump and the goods or the bads, his attempt at cutting the funds for education within NASA, I thought was a short-sighted.
I hope you don't mind if I don't touch that one.
Well,
I don't mind at all.
Well, I'll touch it because the attempt was the money is really small and the Office of Education is really poorly run and managed and the money gets wasted. But let me tell you about California, because my kids are now 34 and 36. And when they were in science in public high school in Marin County, which is supposed to be one of the better counties for education in California, they adopted the new standards for UC. That's the standard for high school science called integrated science. So my kids were one of the first or second groups in high school to be subject to integrated science. So no longer did you have to take a science class like chemistry or geology or physics or chemistry, whatever it might be. You could take, to quote another famous politician, a smithering of all of those sciences in one collective course, and Berkeley or the UC system would accept that integrated science as having met your high school science requirements. So no longer did you have to really have a science class, and you could have taken any science class you wanted. You could just take a little bit of this and a little bit of that and do it. When they came to the space topics in their class, their textbooks were way beyond antiquated, and I was already doing the space show and had my interest in space, or was working on my dissertation in commercial space at the time. And I saw their space chapters. My kids gave them to me and said, Dad, can you believe this is what they're teaching us? Because my kids were learning about space from me years before they even made it to high school. And I went in and asked the teachers to let me do a guest lecture on space, because the textbooks were like 20 years behind the time. And I gave them my credentials and all of this, and not one teacher over the years would allow me to do it, because they said our curriculum is controlled by the school board and by the state of California, and we have no time for guest speakers, and we have to teach the required material for the test that the students are going to take, and we know the books are outdated, but this is what we have to work with, but thank you anyway. And that was years before Trump ever did anything other than develop real estate and casinos in Atlantic City. So to lay this problem or even think about it on any particular politician, let alone him, this damn problem has been going on in our science stuff for 25, 30 years, maybe even longer. I mean, I go back about 20 years.
Absolutely agree.
So broaden your thinking if you want to go lay blame to it, because...
No, I don't want to blame Trump. I recognize that the problem is associated with our schools and goes back decades. It's just a lack of interest in the society to invest in their children's future.
And remember, the lack of this interest goes across the board to other things. So people probably don't care about the NASA Office of Education. You know, that NASA book they print on spin-offs and things that have happened to benefit humanity, medicine, you know, the economy, that they print every 2 years, is just, it's an incredible encyclopedia of the value of spaceflight, both scientific spaceflight and human spaceflight. And it doesn't get disseminated. You know, people who listen to this show may know about it. It's free. You just have to ask NASA for a copy of it, and you get a copy of it. It's an incredible book. Try to use it as an argument for supporting spaceflight or this or that with space, and it falls flat on its face. How do you explain that? It's being handed to people for free on a silver platter, what space has done for all of us, including people in Africa and around the world, for emergency relief, disasters, the tsunami, you know, floods years ago. I used to do shows on all of that and the role of space and space resources in emergency preparation and saving people's lives and stuff. And you think anybody picks up on it, or the politicians pick up on it of either party, or the schools pick up on it? What school offers that spin-off book? I'll bet you can't find it in 1% of high school libraries in the country. And I'm telling you, that is such a valuable and enlightening book. I don't know what to say. It's a sore point with me. You can tell I'm back up on my soapbox again.
Well, it's a little sore point for me, too.
You know, and if you don't have that spin-off book, listeners, I would urge you to Google it for NASA and request your free copy of it and take it with you everywhere and shove it in people's face and say, this is why space is so important. And tell the story. NASA doesn't tell the story very well, but we can tell the story. Anyway, I'm sorry, Mike. I didn't mean to encroach upon your time.
Thank you for your time, Mike.
Mark, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Mike, you still there, or did you give up on us?
No, I'm fine. Just listening.
That is really a terrific book on spinoffs. I never have understood why it doesn't catch fire and be a bestseller or a best giveaway. I guess it's not a seller since it's for free.
I hope my book becomes a bestseller, but it's not a giveaway. So,
well, it should be, you know, that's why we're featuring it on the Space Show, Forward to Spaceflight. Have we missed anything in our discussion? Is there something more we should have asked you or that you want to feature or talk about?
Oh, I appreciate the time you've given me to talk about where it evolved from and what it is. And to answer some of the questions on aspects that I hadn't considered before. I'm always happy to talk about it more.
Where do we get it?
When you start talking about getting me talking about books and the history of spaceflight, that can last hours and hours. But time is limited for you, so the book is published by Apogee Publishing out of Burlington, Ontario, Canada. And I think that you have the information available on your website.
Yeah, I do, and I'll make sure I put the link to the Apogee page. Is it also on sites like Barnes & Noble and Amazon? Is it available there as well, or do you have it available directly from you?
I do not have it available directly. Copies are coming from Apogee. I know they've shipped to some distributor locations, but I think that was in the UK. They have a distributor over there. Offhand, I don't know what their arrangement is with Amazon or Barnes & Noble. But it's a publication that how many niches it'll fill, but it is relatively unique. Because it's illustrated this time, it's interesting to look at. It's not just text throughout a book that would only be of interest to a librarian, for example, or a purely historian. I mean, the visual feast, as one person called it, is is one nice aspect. And then the really unique, important part of this in particular is the Russian addendum. There's nothing like this that's out there that Asif and I have been able to identify that captures together and compiles all of the books in Russian that were published before Sputnik on the development of rocketry and dreams of spaceflight. So I'm obviously, you know, keen on this. This is the second updated edition of the book. I continue to maintain updates. So if someone picks up a copy and finds an error or an update and wants to pass it along, I would appreciate that.
Okay. We will talk to you again, I am sure, and follow you with this book. And listeners, if you can't find it on BNN or Amazon, I will put in the Apogee website for the book, and you can always get a hold of it there as well. So, Mike, great book, and thank you for this continuation of this great work and for an excellent and really interesting space show discussion. We appreciate your being here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I will probably archive late tonight or early in the morning. I'll send you all of that information. And listeners, a full week of the Space Show this week, except no show on Friday. You can see that on the Space Show upcoming shows and newsletters. Everybody have a great week coming up. Keep looking up, and thanks to Mike and all of you who called and emailed. Goodbye from the Space Show.